to landscape professional. Currently, we have a two-license system, which is confusing in the contracting world. We have an individual that takes a competency exam that allows that individual then to perform and to supervise those people that are unlicensed, that are employed by a landscaping business. That individual that takes that competence exam can perform landscape work and can supervise, directly supervise, those that are unlicensed, that are employed by the landscaping business. That person today is referred to as a landscape contractor. The term is erroneous because that person cannot contract. And it confuses the consumer into thinking, okay, he's a licensed landscape contractor, therefore that individual can come and perform work for me, when in fact that individual does not carry the bond, doesn't carry the insurance, doesn't carry the workers' comp, and is not the entity that can do the contract. The landscaping business is the second license we have that is the entity that carries the bond, carries the insurance, carries the workers' comp, protects the consumer. And that business has to employ or be owned by a licensed landscape individual, the contractor. So we're changing that term landscape contractor to professional because it more reflects the role of that individual in the business. That individual is not a contractor. It is a person that has demonstrated the skills to do that work, and it's very similar to the journeyman plumber and the journeyman electrician in a plumbing business and an electrician business. That journeyman person has demonstrated the competency, has to be working for, be employed by a plumbing business, that they get that business license through the Construction Contractors Board. So we're asking for that change so that we can make that distinction a little clearer to the consumer. Now, I'll answer any questions you have to clarify if you like.
Question?
Yeah, getting back to 2074.
Yes, sir.
If I'm reading this correct, and maybe I'm not, but let's say that I decide to go out and purchase a landscaping business, and I don't want to work in it. I don't care about it. Just a business investment to me. Am I required to get a license?
This is Chair Schaffler, Representative Escobar. What this is saying, if you're going to own that business, then you would have to take a 16-hour class and pass the laws and rules and the business practice part of that exam before you could own that business. You would not have to work in the business in the sense that you wouldn't be the person that would be supervising the landscape work. You would have to employ a licensed individual that has demonstrated the competency part of the exam to supervise the landscape work of that business. But you as the owner, if you're going to own that business, you would have to demonstrate to the board that you knew what the laws and rules were for landscaping businesses. You would need to know what the contract law was, need to know what the employment laws were regarding landscaping businesses.
Well, okay, then what you're telling me is that if I purchase a company that has landscaping as a subsidiary, I have to be licensed even though I don't know or want to know anything about landscaping, and that I have a management team in place that has the proper credentials and the proper licenses, but I still have to go to school. Why would that be beneficial to me if I weren't going to be involved in the business?
Because you're the one that's owning that business, is fiscally responsible for it. So if there's any kind of claims that come against the business, if there's any kind of contract difficulty that comes to the business, you're the ones going to be held responsible. If you don't know what those are, you could be in jeopardy for violating the law.
Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On
in reference to House Bill 2074, this examination and the courses are aimed strictly at the applicants. Is there any provisions that address current businesses that are licensed that have not passed these same courses and examinations?
Yes, on the section four deals with after any license, any business that's in existence before January 1, 2008 would not have to have the business owner take this exam. If the business goes into effect after January 2008, before that license is renewed in 2009, the business owner would have to demonstrate that they have taken the classes and passed the exam. So any existing businesses that are in place today, the business owner does not have to take that exam.
But when they renew it, they would?
If the business formed, Representative Holdy, if the business started after January 1, 2008, then they would have to demonstrate.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I have a couple questions.
I would love to.
Mr. Snyder, this is new language for me.
I understand.
Somewhere in here, in reading through these, I came up with a distinction between a landscape contractor, a landscape business, and a yard maintenance somebody. Would you please go over that with me and assure me that in statute there is some distinction here that my constituents would understand?
Representative Schaffler, Representative Berger. The Landscape Contractors Board regulates landscape construction. And so it's defined in statute that means the planning and installing of lawns, trees, shrubs, and other nursery stock. It also includes decks, fences, arbors, water features, irrigation systems, that type of work. It's a construction board.
So what we're talking about today only applies to those businesses.
That is correct.
Does not apply to the guy with a rake.
That is correct.
Coming around. I just wanted that on the record.
Landscape maintenance is not regulated in the state of Oregon at this time.
Okay. Can I have one more question?
Yes, by all means.
I'm trying to be brief.
You're doing great.
2117, There's a whole bunch of new language in the back, what I call the metro provisions. Do you want to talk about what those are?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Berger. This is language LC put in for, with the language to bring it closer to what the Construction Contractors Board has now, which is that they work in conjunction with Metro that issues licenses to people that do landscape work. Mm-hmm. And so this language is it's almost a direct mirror of what the Construction Contractors Board have for dealing with Metro and the licensing requirements that they have.
Can I continue?
Pardon me?
Can I continue?
Yes,
I understand these provisions are in order to clarify the obligations and sort of business fee pieces between organizations doing business in and out of whether their offices or headquarters are there and or not. And I'm always struck by language that says the Legislative Assembly intends to reduce the number of city business licenses. If that's the intent, is that the intention of this section to reduce the number of city licenses that?
Yep. Excuse me, Representative.
To ease the burden of the companies that are trying to operate in this venue.
Chair Schaffer, Representative Berger. My understanding is that Metro incorporates all the cities within Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties so that you can go to the metro and get a license to perform landscape work, and you don't have to go to each city and get a license to work in that city. Now, Portland, the city of Portland, has its own little world around that.
But in
Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County, that metro license, you can go down and get one license, and you're allowed then to perform work in all those counties without having to go to each local jurisdiction and purchase a new license.
Which, Mr. Chair, in my opinion, is a very desirable thing.
Thank you. Any other questions today on these three bills? Glad to see Representative Rosenbaum is with us. I know you're busy. Okay.
We're too busy for you.
All right, Mr. Snyder, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that feels compelled to testify today to these bills? All right. Well, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2074, 2075, and 2117. And we're just going right down the line,
yes,
right? And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2223. And are these folks all together?
I believe these three are. And we also have Michael Wood from OSHA. So we'll
okay. All right, then. Mr. Wood, please, would you come up and just tell us what you got today?
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I am the administrator of the Oregon Occupational Safety and Health Division, Oregon OSHA, within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to provide information and request the committee's support of House Bill 2223. I have provided written testimony. I will just touch on some of the highlights in the interest of brevity and give you the opportunity to ask any questions. This bill is introduced at the request of DCBS in order to address an issue that can make it more difficult for us to fulfill our mission of protecting workers from hazards that can cause serious injury, illness, and death. In addition, the same issue actually can create an unlevel playing field where businesses that are playing by the rules and that are fulfilling their obligations under the law actually end up at a competitive disadvantage to businesses who choose not to do so. Like every other occupational safety and health jurisdiction in the nation, Oregon OSHA issues penalties for serious violations when we find them in the workplace. Unlike some other jurisdictions, indeed most other jurisdictions, our penalties for a first instance violation of that sort are actually relatively modest. In fact, on a nationwide basis, the average penalty for a serious violation of an occupational safety and health rule is lower in the state of Oregon than it is in any other state in the country. Although these first instance penalties are relatively modest, the law and our rules provide for much stiffer penalties if an employer fails to correct a violation or if an employer allows a similar violation to occur at some point in the future. For a certain minority of employers, and I do believe it's a minority of employers, it is the risk of such failure to abate or repeat violations and the penalties that accompany them that encourages them to comply with the rules and to keep their workers safe. Unfortunately, it may be possible under the current law for an employer to avoid this ongoing responsibility. Subsequent to an inspection and a receipt of a citation, Oregon employers may be able to change their business status in a way that allows them to avoid responsibility for that current citation as well as the ongoing history for future citations. The change can be fairly modest. For example, a construction business that was previously registered as a corporation called ABC Construction could reincorporate as ABC Contractors Incorporated, allowing it to maintain its brand knowledge and its relationship with its customers, but to transfer its experience and history and become a new entity, at least arguably in the eyes of the law. As you're probably aware, there are several other statutes related to other agencies that address similar issues. Each of us have to approach it a little bit differently because the underlying mission of the law sort of dictates the issues. In our case, we can't easily identify the employers who have taken this step, However, the staff who enforce our rules indicate that it is a meaningful and growing problem, although it is not yet widespread. My written testimony provides some examples that we have taken from the records that we've been able to obtain. And in some cases, it's actually been the case where we have had an employer contest a violation, end up with a substantial penalty against it as a final order. That corporation then closed its doors and reopened them with a new identity. The same owner is doing the same business. The debt is uncollectible, and we start again with those modest first instance penalties because in the eyes of the law, it's arguably a new employer. House Bill 2223 will address these issues by giving us the tools to reduce an employer's ability to avoid responsibility. And it would do so by revising the definition of employer in the statute to allow us to hold a successor entity liable. The burden, of course, would be on us to demonstrate that the business can clearly be considered a successor to the original enterprise. The bill before you would provide a general successorship test in the statute itself. However, continued discussions with our stakeholders have led us to conclude that it would be more appropriate to supplement that statute's general guidance with the requirement that before we use this test, we develop rules that provide more explicit criteria identifying in what circumstances we would hold the successor employer accountable. And we plan to work with legislative counsel to develop amendments to this bill that will take that approach. I want to make clear that beyond the ability to pursue a corporation or a business as it changes identities, this is not an attempt to pierce the corporate veil. Our purposes do not require that we hold corporate officers personally liable for penalties that have been assessed. What serves the interests of our mission, and ultimately the workers and businesses in the state, is the ability to hold an employer who continues to do business liable even though they may change the name or change the business entity slightly. And in that case, it allows us not only to protect those workers, but as I said earlier, to provide a level playing field for the workers who are accepting their obligations under the law and paying penalties in those cases where they've been assessed. Thank you, and I appreciate the opportunity to have testified. I'd be happy to respond to any questions you may have.
Representative Edwards.
Thanks for coming to testify. Would it be your contention that business owners are closing the doors on their business in order to avoid second offense, stiffer second offense type penalties? Or is your contention that through the course of businesses shutting down, starting back up, that just a lot of business owners are missing second, or they're not being held accountable for second offenses?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, I think my answer would be that businesses in some cases are doing both. I think it's certainly there are a number of legitimate reasons why a business may close its doors and reconfigure. It certainly is appropriate and not at all unusual for a sole proprietorship to close its doors and be replaced by a corporation. When I look at some of the examples in front of me where we have corporations that close their doors as a corporation owned by a single person and then reopen their doors as another corporation owned by that same single person, I don't know whether it's simply to avoid responsibilities related to our statute, but it is difficult to avoid the conclusion that in some cases, at least, it's a conscious effort to sort of redefine itself in order to avoid obligations under the law.
Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're talking about business configurations, maybe you can clarify for me, in a case where a business hires a labor leasing company or temporary agency and there's a violation, and the employees are technically, I guess, employed by the temp agency or the leasing company, is that a violation shared by both the temp agency and the company who is directing the people on the particular job site?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Hovey, that's one of those frightening questions that leaves a bureaucrat saying it depends. Those tend to be very fact-specific determinations. Both may have responsibility. The prevailing law tends to focus on issues of control. So typically, if the leasing company is providing employees without any supervision, the most obvious liability generally falls to the site employer, the employer who's controlling the activity. But there are, depending on the nature of the violation, depending on the nature of the employer knowledge and the issues of control related to a particular violation, either employer might be cited, and in certain cases it's actually possible that both employers might be cited.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Schaffer. Representative Edwards, please.
Would this proposal have that the legislation or that the statute follows the employer should they reorganize if they change sites, their primary location of business? Say there's a small mill owner and they close down this mill and they buy another mill, or say that mill goes out of business and they move across town and or across the valley and they open up another mill with really different configuration of equipment and whatnot, would previous offenses then follow them to the new location?
Chair Schaffler, Representative Edwards, I believe in that case it would be unlikely that we would make the argument or could make the argument that it was substantially the same business. Now, if a construction company were to change its office location, then I think we'd argue that represented the same substantial business. And this is actually an illustration of why there's probably value in hammering out some more specific criteria in rulemaking rather than relying simply on a general statement in the statute.
Thank you.
And Representative, I could only hope they are opening up more mills. But that's my side point there. Any other questions?
Let's vote on it. No.
Yeah. All right.
More
well,
mills.
If you're finished, then thank you for coming. And
thank
we'll
you.
Have some folks that want to testify to this, too. And, I believe you're all together, Wayne Barlow, and Art Kuzmins. And Bill Gustafikin, forgive me for, they butcher Schaffler all the time, so I understand. Otis, come on up and tell us what you got to say today. And just so you know, I know Mr. Barlow knows this, but you have to state your name, identify yourself to the committee, and then give your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lane Barlow. I'm the authorized representative for the Russian American Builders Association, which is mostly Russian contractors in the Woodburn, North Marion County area. We oppose House Bill 2223 as it currently stands. We have written testimony for you, of course, and it's no need to go and read all that. We have some really big concerns here. Mr. Wood, with all due respect, talked about a lot of mites in response to your questions. But the bill, as it now stands, paints the situation with a very broad brush. The bill, as it now stands, for instance, would piggyback any citations or penalties wherever that person, the owner, the directors, wherever they go, into new entities, to new projects, and so forth. And as Mr. Gostevsky sitting next to me pointed out, what about if there was actually federal bankruptcy protection? This bill does not allow for that and would actually not only pierce the corporate veil, but also piggyback along regardless of a bankruptcy. We can go what if here as much as we can, but let's just say we are opposed to we oppose the bill as a current stance. There's I think that a person who is trying to make a living, and we deal with mostly small contractors who are off this winter because there's no work. Mr. Kuzman on the end here, I don't think he planned to testify. He's our president. He has an active dispute with the Consumer and Business Services. We think they're wrong in some ways, and I'd say that we're in the process of working this out with their executives, and I hope it has a good outcome. However, what his dispute points out is what can happen when a person, a bureaucrat, has free use of the state letterhead and the kind of damage and havoc that can be wreaked. Let's just say that we oppose the bill. We are prepared to assist in amending the bill so it's something that's good for Oregonians and good for Oregon and something that's more palatable for the committee to pass. And that's all I have to say.
All right. Mr. Kuzman, do you want to testify to this bill? Not to your dispute. I don't know anything about it, but we're not hearing that today. But if you want to testify to the bill, you're welcome to.
You don't have to. You don't want to.
I'm not much of a talker, so I'm...
Okay.
If I may clarify, Mr. Chair, Mr. Kuzman's our president. He's basically here to show that we're real and more than just my shiny face.
All right, and Mr. Gostevskin. Did I get it right there?
Yes, that's fine.
All right.
My name is Billy Gostevsky. I'm a small contractor out of Hubbard, Oregon. I've dealt with OSHA. I've tried to follow their rules. And I just feel this thing will just give them free rein on pretty much anybody. The way I read it, it seems like Lane Barlow here explained, if somebody went bankrupt and something didn't go right in a company, when he starts off another company, you know, they might figure that out in the future, but the way I read it, you know, it gives a person that OSHA, no matter what happens to the person, they still be somebody still following down the line. So, and who's responsible? The way when I read it, I didn't see who's responsible. Is the board of directors responsible for the same fine if they go out and start a business? Is the vice president liable on that too? And that's about it. So, you know, that's my two cents.
Okay. Any questions of our panel here? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, I'm just curious if anyone does know the questions about bankruptcy, because I was under the impression, depending upon what your bankruptcy is, I know on an individual basis, because I used to dissolve the properties for Chapter 7s in the bankruptcy court. But the first rule was the bankruptcy court made up its own rules. They had the power to overturn most any legislation that was done by a state. So I would like to get an answer if we could, but I'm pretty sure, pretty sure, that the bankruptcy court will trump anything we do in the state of Oregon. That's my opinion.
Representative Esquivel, and Chair Schaffer, may I address this?
Is your question to the agency or to these folks?
I would like to get it from the agency.
Yeah, I think we're going to let that. You can go ahead and address his comments and questions.
Let's weigh on this. Representative Esquivel, I have a lot of respect for your answer, and it means you're thinking. But the way, let's look at the black and white, what this bill says. This bill says they can piggyback and follow you wherever you go, regardless of what we hope the bankruptcy court will do its job. We hope that the agency would recognize what the federal bankruptcy court is going to see. Saying we hope that the bankruptcy trustee would issue an appropriate ruling quickly to the agency. But we can't assume any of that's going to happen, because that's not what this bill says.
And I think this is about OSHA, not the bankruptcy. So, but thanks for your time. And Mr. Woods, would you like to just come up and touch on some of this stuff that we've been talking about so everybody's clear?
He wants to say something.
Okay. I had one more thing.
Okay, go ahead.
I had a situation where, what if it was a partnership that started a company and one business partner was not quite doing his job with the management, and they decided to go their own ways. Well, who's responsible for that when the partnership goes down? That's going to follow the partner that was doing his job and the partner that wasn't, you know. So I think that needs to be cleared up too.
Right. On that. Okay, thanks. I think Mr. Woods will come up here and maybe clarify some of this for us.
With the committee's permission, I'll remain and if there's any more questions or clarification needed.
Do you have any more comments, Mr. Barlow?
No.
Okay, if you don't, then I'm just going to have Mr. Woods up here. All right, thanks a lot.
One anticipated, one obvious question, Chair Schaffler and Representative Esquivel. I am not an attorney, and I'm not a specialist in bankruptcy.
Yeah.
My general understanding of bankruptcy law would have been summed up the same way Representative Esquivel did it just a moment ago, which is the bankruptcy court writes its own rules. I certainly would not anticipate that the penalties owed would cross over bankruptcy, but I made a note already to inquire and check that issue. With the staff at DCBS who understand those issues. I think if the ownership, I mean, within the intention of the bill, if the ownership and the business was substantially the same entity both before and after bankruptcy, there would be the question of OSHA history. And my expectation would be that bankruptcy clears financial issues. It doesn't resolve you of previous responsibility for violation history, and so consistent with the purposes of the Act, and in fact the explicit language of the Act, I think we would still take history into account. And I believe we'd do that in a bankruptcy now, which doesn't involve a new corporate entity. So really I don't know that this is an issue specific to the bill. This is an issue that would come up in the existing law, since when a corporation declares bankruptcy, it then begins operation again as the same corporation, and the questions of successorship are not at issue, simply the issues of financial responsibility.
And the contractors board, Craig Smith was in my office today, we are going to be dealing with if an entity declares bankruptcy and whether or not that's put down on the record or not. There's going to be a bill which we'll to discuss at length and Mr. Representative Holby's committee. So, all right, any other questions for Mr. Woods while we got him here? Alrighty then. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it. I'm going to close.
Thank you.
You're welcome. The hearing on House Bill 2223 and open a hearing on House Bill 2079. And I'm going to call, is that Carl?
Carol
Reeves. Forgive me. And is Mr. Reeves around?
Okay, I'll look one more time.
Okay.
I've been seeing both of them. All right, one more speaker.
All right. Hello. How are you?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you very much for allowing the Board of Accountancy to provide information to you on this bill. There's a certain advantage in being the last one on the agenda in the afternoon. Many people start yawning when you mention public accountants or accounting rules, and so there will be fewer people bored by my testimony. As you already know, the Board of Accountancy regulates the profession of public accountants in Oregon through its regulation, and one of its primary regulatory tools, of course, is relates to licensing requirements. This bill is probably more complicated to explain the changes than it is than they really are. But there are four different licensing provisions that are addressed by this bill, and it might be considered that this is kind of a house cleaning bill because the board proposed the bill to amend any ambiguities that there may be regarding licensing requirements. With your permission, Mr. Chair, I will address these in order that they are listed on the committee sheet that I gave you. There are four of them, and I'll kind of give a little pause after each one and allow you, if you have any questions at that time, I'd be happy to address them. I'll address the first one, which is something called substantial equivalency. The public accounting profession in recent years has undergone significant changes, most notably those changes that result from increased demands to provide client services across state lines. And since every state has different licensing regulations, sometimes that raises problems and time constraints for licensees who have client demands with deadlines. As a result, the various state boards of accountancy collaborated to develop a licensing standard that is called substantial equivalency to facilitate the interstate practice by licensed, certified public accountants from one state to another. These provisions are embodied in what is called the Uniform Accountancy Act, which is a model act, and like all model acts, states choose what they will adopt for their state regulations. The Oregon Board approved the provisions of substantial equivalency in 1999. The revisions that are in House Bill 2079 are necessary now because the Uniform Act has changed, has been modified since 1999, and the Board wants to be sure that certified public accountants coming from other states meet the requirements in Oregon before they're issued a substantial equivalency license to practice in Oregon. For example, the primary change is that under the Uniform Act, substantial equivalency applicants have now until the year 2012 to meet the standards in order to practice in a state that accepts this standard as Oregon has. When Oregon approved in 1999, there was only a 5-year grandfather period, so to speak, to allow individuals to meet these standards and still be accepted. The board is unwilling to extend that grandfathering out until the year 2012, and so the purpose of this provision is to clarify Oregon's requirements for substantial equivalency. Going on. The next paragraph is purely clarification, but it has an interesting little twist. This same problem has arisen because chartered accountants, who are the equivalent, so to speak, of certified public accountants in foreign countries, often wish to practice in the United States or in a state. By the same token, some of our licensed certified public accountants wish to practice in Canada because our clients today do not just cross state lines, they also cross global lines. And as you all know, we are in an increasingly global economy that requires people like certified public accountants and public accounting firms to meet the needs of those clients who have business offices or other business in another country. Provisions were also developed that would allow reciprocity for chartered accountants who are licensed by a recognized foreign country to be eligible for licensing in the United States. Oregon has also adopted those provisions. The language in the statute is not clear that this chartered accountant must be licensed by a foreign country that is recognized by the board. And that is the only change that we're making here. For your information, there are currently four agreements between the appraisal body and foreign countries that have approved recognized chartered accountants. These are from Ireland, Canada, two from Australia, and one from, I think I got the answer sheet here, Mexico. Mexico. And pending is a request for consideration and evaluation by chartered accountants licensed in India. No questions on foreign jurisdictions? It's not really very complicated. It's just a clarification of ambiguous language. The third section relates to licensing requirements for a level of accountant that is licensed in Oregon, and this level is called public accountant. It is a licensed public accountant. The entry requirements for a public accountant are less rigorous than those for a certified public accountant. And to compensate for that, the public accountant applicant must demonstrate experience in public accounting at two different intervals. They must demonstrate 2 years of public accounting experience prior to taking the exam that qualifies them for a license, and they must demonstrate a third year of experience in public accounting after taking the exam and prior to licensing. These experience requirements are subject to the same supervision and standards as are the experience requirements for a certified public accountant. The language in the provisions for a licensed public accountant, once again, because of the position in the sentence, were somewhat ambiguous, and we want to make it clear that this experience requirement must meet the same standards as all experience requirements for licensing in Oregon. And finally, the least complicated has occurred because in 2004, the traditional exam for certified public accountants and public accountants, which is a uniform exam, was successfully transitioned to a computer-based exam. Prior to that time, anyone who wished to become licensed in Oregon found their way to the state fairgrounds, assembled in one of the state fairground exhibit halls for 2 days to take four sections of the certified public accounting exam. In 2004, after many years of preparation, the exam on a national basis was transitioned to a computer-based exam. And there are approved computer testing services or outlets in every state. In Oregon, there are three. There's one in Eugene, and there are two in Portland. And a candidate now may take the exam in any state. If you happen to live in Baker City, and there is an approved testing center in Boise, and that's easier for you to get to than Portland or Eugene, you are free to choose to take the exam in that center. By the same token, exam applicants now may take any of the four required sections of the exam at any time, in any order, on any day that they wish, whereas before they were limited to this very strict time period under the paper and pencil exam. And under the old standards, you didn't get credit for any past exams unless you had achieved a certain score in all four exams. So those are outdated requirements that no longer exist. Today, in this effort to facilitate licensing and practice of public accountancy, if you take a section of the exam in Boise, Idaho, and you did it as an Idaho candidate, and you want to transfer that credit to Oregon because guess what? You decided Astoria is a nicer place you'd like to live. You may do so without establishing that conditional credit that I just mentioned, which is probably more complicated than I described. So it's simply a relaxing and a flexibility of the standards of the exam. That language was missed when we were making the changes in anticipation of the transition to the computer exam, and so we want to make sure that it's taken out now because it's no longer a requirement. I am happy to address any questions you may have.
Representative Berger.
Yeah, I didn't jump in. We wanted to take them in order, and on the first one I had a quick question.
Okay.
Don't need a long explanation. I assume that Oregon's laws are tougher than the Uniform Accountancy Act. We aren't moving the other way. We're moving our statutes take precedent. I'm a little concerned when you have sort of a statewide system that changes and you don't change with it, that you pretty soon you're off here and the rest of the states are off there. And I just want to make that little comment so that I'm sure that you would agree with me that while we want Oregon statute to be, you know, tough and good and something we feel good about, I sure don't want us to go off one way and we get so far away from this uniform accountancy thing that we're off where our accountants can't get jobs in other states and vice versa.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to address that. There are two standards of substantial equivalency. The first is if you are licensed in a state that has been determined to be substantial equivalency under three criteria, experience, exam, and education, then you're home free. But if you're, and there are 44 of 54 jurisdictions which, in fact, are substantially equivalent. And the primary area that defines or distinguishes those which are and those which are not is the education requirement that came into being in Oregon in the year 2000 and other states slowly. And that education requirement was increased to 150 hours, which must include a bachelor's degree and an additional 30 hours in higher education. So, California, for example, meets that standard only for one level of licensee. They still have the opportunities to be licensed without meeting that level. Colorado is another state that has not yet seen it appropriate for their state to adopt the 150-hour requirement. So if you are licensed in Colorado or California, or I have a cheat sheet here, the other territories that don't meet the standard are Guam, Puerto Rico, the Northern Marianas, the Virgin Islands, Florida, Colorado. There's some eastern state, I'm sorry, I can't think of it, and California sort of quasi. So the number, if you're an individual who's licensed in these states, but you as an individual do meet the requirement, you were a great student, and you went through, you got 150 hours because you loved it, you meet them. You know, you are substantially equivalent, and it is this level that the Uniform Act has seen fit to extend for another 12 years. And our board does not feel that that's appropriate because our folks are required to meet this standard. And so we did, when we initially adopted it, agree to the grandfathering provision through the year 2005. Seven, I think it was. And then another 5 years takes it to 2012 because it went into effect in 2002 in the Uniform Act. So they took it out 5 years, and the board approved that in its approval, and we tied our statute to the Uniform Act in our language. And so now they've extended out another 5 years, which makes it 10. And the board feels that 2007 is sufficient time for these folks to be do what they need to do to become substantially equivalent if they truly want to be licensed here, and do not wish and want to be clear that we're not tied to any future changes in the Uniform Act, because the Uniform Act is not a binding act on anyone. It is only to the extent that a state chooses to adopt those provisions. And our error was in tying our adoption of that provision to the Uniform Act language. So we want to make clear now that our standards are, and our standards are this. If you are not substantially equivalent, and you hold a license in another jurisdiction, you may come into Oregon under reciprocity provisions, and they are very lenient. There are several ways that you may practice in Oregon under reciprocity provisions. So it is not a situation where suddenly we're going to be way out on the far side of left when other states have gone one way. In fact, Oregon was one of the first states to approve to accept approval of substantially equivalent candidates or applicants into our state. There were only 8 states initially who had taken on these provisions as a method of licensing. It has taken 4 years for 44 other jurisdictions to do the same as Oregon was early in doing. But may I say, even Oregon public accountants have a history of being ahead of game. I have nothing further unless you have further questions.
Any further questions? Ms. Reeves, would you stay here while Mr. Hughes comes up and gives his testimony in case any more questions or triggers? And I'm not a CPA, and I'm never going to be one, but I know Representative Butler is one. And if you would be so kind, a bill like this may end up on the consent calendar. But just in case it doesn't, and one of us has to carry it, I would sure hope that Representative Butler's okay with everything.
Surely.
Because he's an expert in this field, and I ain't. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the suggestion.
Right.
And sooner or later it would have occurred to me, but as of yet I've not discussed this bill with Representative Butler. But we have worked closely with him in past legislative sessions, and certainly appreciate his counsel and his opinion on bills that we pass. So thank you for that suggestion.
My pleasure. Thank you. Mr. Hughes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes here today representing the Oregon Association of Independent Accountants. That association is made up of tax preparers, tax consultants, public accountants, and a sprinkling of CPAs. I was not sure what I was going to say today because I was not sure what Carol's rationale was and their board rationale on introducing this bill. I think it's a great bill, all except Section 3. And that deals with public accountants, and it allows the board to set the standards for public accounts when that is now in the statute. I don't believe at all it's ambiguous. It's worked. And maybe it sounds like nitpicking, but why not just leave it in the statute? That's my only comment, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Carol, you want to speak to that at all today? Sure. Or?
Certainly. I'm not sure if I understand Mr. Hughes correctly. We're not taking anything out of statute. We're just adjusting the language to make it clear that what the experience requirements are, that they have been established by rule. They have always been established by rule. The rules are not changing. It's just to clarify that that experience must meet those standards. One of the standards, for example, is that it must be supervised by a licensee, whether that person be a licensed certified public accountant or a licensed public accountant. And that supervisor licensee must have an active license, and it must have been active 5 years prior to the supervision and during the entire time of supervision. The reason for that is so that the person who's providing supervision has complied with continuing education, has maintained competency in the areas of practice that now he is acting as a mentor or a supervisor licensee. That is the particular provision that has been confusing on a very small number of occasions when someone has asked whether or not the experience prior to the exam, the two-year experience, had to be subject to a supervisor licensee. And under in the board's view and under all past practice and experience, it has been that the case.
Okay, any more questions?
Mr. Chairman, yes, over the years, over the legislative sessions, we've always insisted that the language be put in the statute and give the Board of Accountancy as little authority as we can. And this is more of the same here. It does give them an expansion, in my opinion, of their rule authority downstream where they can add on and add on. Because the Board of Accountancy, by the way, has a majority of CPAs on it by far. And so we're a little bit suspect and suspicious, and Carol knows that. We always have been, of getting into them getting into our turf. So that's why I'm here today.
Well, I'm a new chair, and if I'd have known you two were going to be battling it out here, I would have had one of you sit way back there. But anyway, this is just a public hearing, and I'm confident we can all, you all can get together and talk about it, and we'll see what happens. In
Mr. Chairman, Carol, if you could take me out and buy me a drink and explain in more detail why they need this.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Okay, no more questions, right? All right, well, I'll close the public hearing then on House Bill. You didn't have any questions to do. Well, that's what I kind of did. I'll talk to him. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2079. And unless there's any more, and I know especially you, Representative, Mr. very busy.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, excuse me.
I'd like to note how quickly the accountancy bill cleared the room.
Did you notice that?
Sorry, Carol.
Carol was the only one there.
It just doesn't add up. I don't know.
I don't understand it, Mr. Chair, but I did notice.
I thought it was interesting. I didn't know anything about it. Hey, I know we're all really busy, but when we do come to vote, if we can communicate and know where we're all at. And Pat, Representative Smith is sick today. She went home sick. I hope she's all right, but that's all. I know, especially you, Representative, are very busy, so had a lot going on over there.
Mr. Chair, I'm sure many people on this committee are very busy, so I don't
Right. Okay.
expect any special consideration.
And Paul's committee backs right up